Welcome to the Better Incidents Podcast, where we hear from reliability-obsessed responders who are at the forefront of the movement to better manage, remediate, and learn from incidents. I'm your host, Robert Ross. One of the first things we have to do in the beginning of an incident is get the right people in the room. But how do you know who to flag and where to find them? Today, I'm talking to a longtime friend, Brian Lyles, VP and Principal Engineer for VMware. We're going to talk about the importance of a service catalog and how to take the first steps towards formalizing one. Let's jump right in. First off, thanks for doing this. This is the first one we're doing. We have a bunch of others set up too, but always love chatting with you. So, and I know you've done this a million times before, so I'm not even going to try to tell you what to do because I know you got this. So first off, welcome, Brian. Brian Lyles from VMware. So Brian, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? What do you do at VMware? What's your experience? And, you know, take it away.
Okay. Well, we'll start what I'm doing now. I am a principal engineer at VMware. I am the principal engineer of our telco and edge practice. What that means is that I do regular computer stuff, like a lot of other engineers, a lot of distributed systems, but I also have to do that in the context of telco. And for those of you all who don't know, telco is just like all the rest of computing. But we have this very interesting aspect where things can never go down, things are never right, and we have lots of our compute outside of data centers, because you look up and see a telephone pole in a kilometer or less, there is going to be a cell site with compute there. So that is a very, very large challenge. It's different than any type of computing that I've ever done, but it's still pretty nice. But before this, over the past, longer than quarter century, I've worked in every aspect of what has been called cloud today, from ISPs to the first web hosting company, to being on the team that invented the term SaaS, to being one of the first employees at a cloud company, to actually helping a large bank move to the cloud, and to doing whatever we're doing at VMware with multi-cloud. I've seen it all, and I think I bring a pretty unique aspect or viewpoint to this whole world of cloud and computing.
Yeah, and you know, we worked together at one of those clouds too, and I don't think there was a piece of the stack at that company that we didn't touch, or especially use, you know, layer 1 through 7, there was something that you were touching over there. So down to the power distribution units too. So that's great. And, you know, we chatted recently and we were talking about incidents and incident management. And I'm kind of curious, you know, what is your kind of experience right now managing incidents in your career? Where have you done it? What kind of incidents have you managed? And was that something you were dragged into? Was that something you were assigned? Did you volunteer? You know, what's that story?
I mean, my career started when there were no pager duties or fire hydrants or anything of the like. And the only way to get notified or to notify a team member if something went crazy was to rig up your own paging system, and everyone carried a pager. I've been there. And throughout the years, I've worked on many teams that handled incidents, whether it be ops teams or it would be engineering teams that actually carried a pager. And what I found is that we went from pure chaos and everyone running around with their heads cut off to today, where it's pure chaos and everyone's running around with their heads cut off and everything in between. And I will say that there is good incident handling out there. When I worked at a very large bank, we actually approached it like with military level precision, where we had incident commanders and everybody knew what they needed to do. But still, even to this day, at huge, well-funded companies, it's kind of like all the anti-patterns, which would include we don't know what's broken. We don't know who to call. We don't know who's in charge. We don't know what's going to be fixed, and we don't know if we're going to be able to prevent this from happening again. So it's still a wide open world here when it comes to incident handling and incident management.
Yeah, and for that previous company, the large bank, how did you get to that point, right? That to have a militaristic, you know, process around incident management, that's pretty hard to implement, right? So how did everyone become convinced that that was valuable?
Okay, well, you know, Bobby, you probably noticed this now that you become CEO from becoming an engineer. There's two ways you can motivate people: with a carrot or a stick. And whenever you're dealing with a bank and there's billions, literally billions of dollars on the line, no one talks about the carrot anymore. It's a stick. So the way that we ensured that we were losing the least amount of money at any particular time during some kind of incident was to hold a stick. And the way that we made sure that we did this is that we were actually very strong about failure. And then but we made sure that everyone had tools. So we actually paid for people to have that title incident commander so that they could actually solve the problems that were at hand. Humans, you know, I'll have to be very honest, humans in our human nature, we like to panic. We like to run around with our heads cut off. But having someone who is paid with a level head saved our butts a few times.
Yeah, I actually do align with that philosophy. You know, paying people to be on call is becoming more and more popular. We're seeing that much more. And I think we were talking about this. I asked, you know, what are you exceptional at when it comes to incidents? And you said you're cool as a fan. I always hear cool as a cucumber, but you said cool as a fan. I like that better. But so like, what's your philosophy there? You know, why do you say cool as a fan? Is that human nature? Is that, you know, tell me about how are you staying cool as a fan whenever there's a problem?
You know what? I think it's in my personality. It's in my brain. I'm not a panicker, which is odd because I have huge anxiety. So I do panic about everything except for broken computers. So then I also know that the worst thing you can do when something is broken and you don't know what it is, or you don't know how to fix it right now, is to turn over every single stone or to call everyone or to panic. The best thing you can do with computers is it's like whenever you see a dog that you don't know, you run, the dog's going to run after you. But if you turn around and stare it in the face, you know, it might still bite you, but many times it won't. It will actually back off a little bit. So I like to look at incidents as that aggressor. And it's like, even what people say with bears, make yourself bigger. I don't know any people who have actually done that, but the word on the street is that if you make yourself bigger, the bear will go away. And that's how I approach incidents. And just to let you know, the cool as a fan is actually a rap lyric. I won't say this.
You know, I should have guessed that. Knowing you, I should have guessed that. I set myself up for failure with that one. So, yeah, I mean, the cool as a fan and making yourself bigger. I like that, right? Because when you're in the heat of an incident, like you're the one that's in control of this thing. If you let the computers control you, it's just going to get worse. So, you know, control the problem yourself, I guess, is maybe where I'm going with that. I don't know. So let's talk about a little bit about the current state of the world where you're at right now. So let's say page goes off and a little bit of chaos ensues. You know, what's the process look like? And also where does incident management kind of sit in the organization today? Is it, do you have a knock? Do you have everyone's on call? What's the landscape?
So at my current place of employment, there is a group we have a horizontal function in our office of the CTO, and he employs people who can act as incident commanders. And the way that we do it typically is someone notices something, and if it's a production outage, they notify another group, and that other group has a incident manager function. And what they'll do is they spin up a Zoom or they'll spin up a Slack channel to actually handle this. It's all manual, but that's generally how it happens. And then what happens is that person who's in charge of the incident is in charge of paging people to make sure that they're brought into the call, and people join and leave that call until the incident is handled.
And what's kind of the triggering point for someone to leave the call and another person to join? Is it like, been 8 hours, go to sleep, or like, you're not helpful, leave, please?
Actually, it's both in a much nicer way. We are a multinational. We have offices literally all over the world. So sometimes it's follow the sun. Sometimes it is, well, you're not really providing anything to this conversation. Let's call somebody who actually can. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about it that way, it's trying to make sure that we have the best people on the call as possible. But I think there still are some gaps where it's not just the people who are handling the problems. It's also management chains who are responsible for the tools that are broken themselves or the tools that depend on them. So sometimes it is very difficult to get that information out to everyone that needs to have it. Whenever you work with 40,000 people, you'll find that finding that person who needs to know is actually very, very hard.
And how is it done? Is it, you know, you put a bat signal in the sky and, you know,
I wish it kind of was like that, but in a lot of cases it's someone who knows and then they're called that way. Oh, you know, someone isn't responsible for XYZ. Let's get them on the phone. There are no automatic call trees across our products. And the reason why that is, it's not through malice or anything like that. It's just because whenever you get into a company that has so many products, I actually don't know how many products we have, but I would say that it's probably in the thousands, that just knowing, no one knows everything. But in a lot of areas, we can, there's points of contact for everything, but that's in Confluence and it's not in some tool where you could actually go and look. And it's definitely not hooked up to our monitoring systems where, oh, this is broken. Who's the POC? So that's, you know, that's a challenge that we do run into.
So when the observability tools you have, I imagine there's a whole bunch of them, are those automatically triggering alerts or in someone's getting paged? I imagine that's the case. So when someone's paged,
yes,
they're the ones kind of recapping here. They're the ones creating a Slack channel, creating a Zoom bridge, getting, you know, someone in the room through these call trees. Is there someone, how does someone say, like, I'm the leader of this incident now? Is it always the person that was dispatched first, or is there not a leader? What is kind of like the roles and responsibilities look like?
I do think that across all of our engineering, I think this depends. So for example, for my things, so let's say a telco, and we have an issue with a large service provider. Now, in that case, I don't think we would have an incident manager. It would be handled within our group, and we would, you know, work the emails, work the phones until we got to who we needed. Now, we also have a bunch of centralized and shared services. Now, with the shared services, I think it's a little bit different. They actually do have the incident managers that will do the right thing and get the people on the phone. And there is a group within the company that does supply incident managers for being able to do that. But that process to me is actually a little bit out of my scope because I don't rely on any of the company's shared services for my products.
Got it. And do you have, what is the measure of success for an incident? You know, I think that you and I both agree that incidents are inevitable. It's that they're just going to happen. What's a good incident? Like, let me restate this. Like, well handled incident.
Okay. So, you know, this is Brian speaking for Brian's sake, not speaking in any official capacity as my position at VMware. So a well handled incident is one that is solved relatively quickly within the, SLA provided. And then after the incident, we actually don't do root cause analysis because I don't believe in it. I think it actually does a whole bunch of bad things to the organization. But afterwards, there are things identified that will ensure that this type of problem, this exact problem, never happens again. And then that information is shared in a place where people can go see it. And then also, we do have a cloud service health review call that happens every Wednesday at lunchtime, my time, where people come in and they'll review an incident. And during that incident, they actually say what timestamps, what happened, who was alerted, what they did, where they left it. And notice that none of that, we're talking about any blame or any excuses. That's a well-handled incident. And really quick here, and notice that I said no blame. We wrote down what happened. We wrote down when it happened. We wrote down who was involved. We wrote down everything that we did and then where we ended up and what we plan on doing next. That's well handled. And I think a lot of teams missed a part of that where they're not blaming. They're saying it wasn't us, so you're blaming someone else. Or when did this happen? They didn't capture a good log. Or even better yet, at the end, what were your next steps? And were they actually followed? Did someone come back through and follow up on, see if widget XYZ was tuned so it could never use this much memory again? And I think that we need to focus on these other things rather than just being good problem solvers.
Yeah, and I totally hear you. I think that not passing around blame is what creates that psychological safety to want to write these documents, right? Like, probably going to do a pretty half-baked document on timestamps and maybe fudge it a little bit if you think you're going to get roasted by this group on their lunch break. How do you create that? How do you ensure that people feel that they're not going to get tarred and feathered when an incident comes out?
Yeah, so this comes from leadership, and I think that more companies and more places need to develop policies where they don't punish failure. Believe it or not, you know, computers can add 1 + 1 and we'll always get 2 unless it's JavaScript. But we put people in unsafe situations where they just don't feel psychologically safe. So they will fudge, not because they're bad people, because they don't want to lose their job or they don't want to lose their bonus. We need to encourage people to fail. But on the other side, we need to encourage people to fail and improve. And whenever you have a culture of failure and improving, then people are not scared to share, hey, you know what? We weren't monitoring the file system. And, you know, this is an example on this particular cache. Because why does cache write the disk? Oh, yeah, you know what? Logs actually made it do this. And then something in systemd did this. And the machine said, nope, I'm not going to do anything anymore. And you know what? There's literally millions and millions and millions of variables in some of these deployments. And we should never, ever punish someone for doing that. What we should do is reward them and actually show them fanfare whenever they're making it, whenever they make their, whatever their uptime numbers go up. That's what we're looking for. Oh, you move from 3 9s to 3 9s and a 5. Right, good job. And the way you found that out is because something went down. But you know what? We really didn't lose any money. But someone got paged in the middle of the night. So what's the loss there?
Yeah. Yeah, I love all of that. One of the things that I always was I was always ambitious with my quick attempts to fix things. Like, I don't know, my philosophy is just restart the damn thing. If I think that's going to fix it, I'm going to restart it. Because at the end of the day, the customer just wants it fixed. They don't care how you really fixed it at really. And as long as it doesn't keep happening, right? But one thing that what companies can do is they can say the best thing you can do is try to fix the incident. And I've never worked with anyone that's nefarious and like trying to solve an incident with like the worst means possible. They're trying to do the best thing that is in their mind at that time with the context provided to solve the problem. So it's hard to, if you start blaming people, they're going to wait until they have a really definitive answer when they might've had one a little earlier that solved the problem just the same.
So it depends on how your compute works out, but I would actually encourage people to not fix things. Don't try to diagnose it. You know what? If you're going to bust an SLA, why don't you just get something else up that works? Especially if you're working in a cloud environment. So many people are working in Google, Amazon, Azure. Just boot up new infrastructure. take the other part out. Don't try to fix it. If it's a security thing, you know, cut it off, shut it off. Let's just get rid of this. But if it's something broken and you know that there's a known good configuration, just get it, just take it out of the pool. And then after, you know, all the blooding or the bleeding is done, then try to fix it. We have this hero culture where people want to go in, you know, with their knife and their fork and fix all these problems. And, you know, I say knife and fork, that sounds silly, but that's how people approach these problems. They go in and they're like, I'm going to go fix this. Why? Bring it up. And then, you know, yeah. What? Then you can go look at it and determine why it failed afterwards, because not one of your customers cares about why it broke. Amazon, like I was on Amazon this morning and I was trying to order a steamer and the page went white. I don't care. It's going to reload the page. I'm not thinking, oh, you know what? Over in US East 1, you know, maybe there was a queue issue. I don't care. None of your customers care. You care.
And you're the person that could actually explain literally everything between your keyboard all the way down to that US East data center, and you still don't care. So if you're thinking about, you know, grandma trying to like look at photos on whatever app, like they definitely don't care. They'll retry.
Make it work. But you know what? You know why people don't do this? And I guess you can't talk about incident handling and on an island. You have to talk about it in the context of automation. You have to talk about it in the context of monitoring and all the things that you need to do to get software into production, because you can't just fix things. But if you have a good stack that allows you to instantly boot a new version of something and, you know, as quick as you can, and no one has to know how it works, that's where the real winning comes with incidents. So there's the on the action side, and then there's the remediation side, and we need to think about those things as well.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk about let's go into our last thing that I wanted to pick your brain on here, which is service catalog. And we actually kind of dipped our toes a little bit. We're talking about how do you get the right person in the room. We're talking about tree calls and all of that. So right now, it sounds like you have a list of all of your services, and at other places, I know you've had that as well. What's the advantage of having a list of all these services, and you know, what can you do with that list? It's because it's not just a list, right? It's much more than that.
Oh, wow. Well, what can you do? Well, first of all, you know, knowing is power. So knowing exactly what's running is good. But then also, if you have a knock, them knowing about all the services means that maybe not only just knowing about the services, knowing about where their metrics are, they can query the metrics, the high-level metrics, and put them on their knock screen so they know that if something breaks, all the high-level things they can look at to determine what actually might be the cause. But something else about having these service trees, you know, every company has, what do you call it? I don't actually, the hierarchy, you know, who reports to who list. That's also very important whenever you need to know if you can't reach the first person, what's the secondary, what's the tertiary, or whatever the fourth one is. Who's the manager? Who's the, you know, general manager in charge of this? Whose P&L, you know, profit and loss is being affected by this outage? And so we need these things so we can know what's affected, who's to be involved, and who might fix this. But companies are, I don't think they do this on purpose, but they like to hide their hierarchies. They don't make them easy to find. We use Outlook. I can go into Outlook and I can kind of find anything, but I can't find it programmatically. And then they change. So having an automated service list that is hooked up with your employee directory that actually doesn't even work on person to person. It works on role. Means that whenever your hierarchies change, that the service ownership, the service management, the service administration changes as well. So guess what? You don't have to do manual work. And I think that's something that we need to apply to more things. Is let's let the computers do what's good, what they're good at. And what are they good at? They are good at keeping track of information and doing calculations, but they're not good at correlation. I mean, people can make that argument for AI, whatever, but still that's hard. So let's let them track these things. And all we need to do is provide simple methods for them to query. And now we don't have to worry about the world when things change, because things always change. Or you know, X and X person or such and such person left the company or got promoted, or we introduce a new product. Change is the only inevitable. It's the only constant. So let's optimize for that. And service catalogs, people catalogs, and all and the like actually help us make sure that being able to know what's going on is constant.
Yeah. And I think that I love what you're saying about the people catalog. I mean, I worked at a HRIS company in the past, and it was actually invaluable to have programmatic access to the list of people that were at the company, who they reported to, were they on PTO. And I think that there's actually going to be a really nice blend in the future, I see, just to better incident management, better service cataloging, all of the, everything you were just saying, by actually tapping into these like human capital management systems too. I think that's actually going to be something we start to see.
No, I agree.
So kind of thinking, looking at the end here, what do you think is kind of next for service ownership, either where you are or where do you see the puck going? Because from where I sit, providing more context, I think that we're kind of at, I'll say 10% conservatively of service ownership across the industry right now. Do you think that's where we're going? Do you think there's another version of the world that, you know, we're marching towards?
No, I think that we're on a path. So we are, let's see, 13 years into the DevOps movement. And then, you know, never let a weird term stand on its own. So we created things like DevSecOps. And I'm sure there's all sorts of DevOps combinations for whatever you're interested in. But really what came out of this is that this whole idea of infrastructure as code or infrastructure as data, configuring things, not with programming and computers, but configuring them with data and configuration. I think this will slowly extend to more metadata coming out about things that are running in production. And we'll be able to use those things to not only do our monitoring or observability, but we'll also be able to use these things to help on the other side. Who's responsible? What does this thing connect to? And the problem right now, and this is why I'm so happy that you're in this space, is that there's just not enough tools and not enough people making noise about this. Like, everyone knows it's a problem. Everyone knows that if you get punched in the stomach, it hurts, but people still get punched in the stomach. So we need more people out there advocating, well, if you don't want to get punched in the stomach, you can do this. And these tools need to be accessible, and you shouldn't have to give up your whole, you shouldn't have to pay, you know, a bajillion dollars to be able to do this. And when it becomes easy, when it becomes, you know, relatively, when it becomes the value is commensurate with the cost, and then when it becomes something that people can set up and it doesn't take a lot of time, I think these things will actually become more prevalent. The problem is that humans are lazy, we're cheap, and we're selfish. And this compounds into computers suck. And that's not the truth. The truth is actually, if we had better tools that were easier to use, that were more affordable, that didn't require us to give up literally our social security numbers and rights to our firstborn children, that we would actually be better off.
Yes, all of that. I think that we're going to start to see that world manifest. It's already happening, right? So I have one kind of like last question here. And we've talked about incident management, we've talked about service catalog, we've talked about a bunch of other things. What do you think comes first? You know, let's say I've started a company and I'm maybe 1 year in, I've got product market fit, I've got a bunch of customers, and maybe I'm even 5 years in. Let's open the aperture here. What comes first, service catalog or incident management?
Incident management is going to come first. And the reason why is because you're going to have incidents. And I think that we need to shore up that practice a little bit better. But I think over time, as either the company and the industry and technology matures, I think that service catalog and ideas like that will be injected earlier. Because think about now and think about tools like Terraform. I remember when Terraform was released, Mitchell Hashimoto is a friend of mine, and I remember when he was developing it and using it.
We were in the office together. Yeah, we were in, yeah. We were in the room. I have the 63rd issue open.
Yes, yes. I was one of the first people to actually like show and use Terraform. And I think that what we're going to find is that more tools that are more accessible, and when they become to go to this level, now I, you know, in a lot of cases, I default to Terraform. Before, I would have wrote a Bash script, or I would have written, or at the time, I could have written Chef or Puppet or something like that. And nope, I don't do that any of that anymore. Sometimes I do Terraform, but now I've moved on to other methods because I use a lot more Kubernetes and things like that. So I use a lot of different set of tools. So I think that what we need to do is we need to do a lot more thinking. We need to have a lot more real talking about this space to figure out, well, we know what we want, but what's actually good and what's not needed. And I think we can, if we start there, then we'll be able to figure out how to make this easier. And if it's easier, young companies can start integrating these things into their processes earlier. I don't want young companies to think about all these crazy things that don't make them money. That's a lot of companies do. They oh, we have this system and this system. I have this fully distributed, you know, Cockroach DB versus their database. But I only have, you know, 50 megs of data or 100 megs of data, or even worse, like even 50 gigs of data. Like, why?
Yeah.
And so we need to make sure that we're bringing in the right tools at the right level with the right set of outcomes for these customers and not give them yet another tool that they have to manage.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that incident management is also can also help you form maybe the culture you want earlier too. I think Service Catalog in the earlier days, is a really great thing to have. You can build so many things off of a Service Catalog, but there's a people component to incident management that I think is often overlooked. Like some of my best friends from the industry are like folks that I literally was on call with. And like, you remember that idiot incident that we had that one time where Spinnaker was rolling back everything instead of rolling forward? And, you know, it's some bonds can be formed definitely through incidents. And I know that definitely with you, had it. We've seen our.
I'm about
fair
to say,
share.
Yeah. Full disclaimer.
We've seen our fair share of drop databases and
yes,
all and yes. You know, emails not being sent and all kinds of things. So, well, hey, thanks so much for coming on here and talking to me about you know, just better incidents and everything that you know from your 25 years plus of experience. So, have a great rest of your day. You're looking good, and talk soon, hopefully.
Thank you. Have a great day, Bobby.
The Better Incidents podcast is lovingly nurtured by the team at FireHydrant and made possible with generous contributions from the Better Incidents Collective. Learn more at betterincidents.com.